Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
We're, I think, on chapter 6, verse 29. Is that right? Is that it? Okay. That's a curious bookmark. Okay, chapter 6, 29. Okay, good. Kalpanta idam alaya shayane ambasi udanvataha shisha yashur anupranam vivishe antar Aham vibohu kalpanta idam adaya shayane. Let me get that again. Shayane basyudanvataha shishayishor of anupranam. Viveshentar aham vibahu. Kalpanta idam adaya. Shayanem vyasyunanvantaha. Shishayishur anupranam. Viveshentar aham vibahu. Kalpanta idam adaya. Shayanem basyunanvantaha. Shishayishur anupranam. Viveshentar aham vibahu. Okay. Kalpa anta. At the end of Brahma's day. Idam. This. Adaya. Taken together. Shayane. Having gone to lie down. Ambasi. In the causal water. Udanvataha. Devastation. Shishayashohu. Lying of the personality of Godhead. Narayana. Anupranam. Breathing. Vivishe. Entered into. Antaha. Within. Aham. I. Vibohu. Of Lord Brahma. Translation. At the end of the millennium, when the personality of Godhead, Lord Narayana, lay down within the water of devastation, Brahma began to enter into him, along with all creative elements, and I also entered through his breathing. Purport. Narada is known as the son of Brahma, as Lord Krishna is known as the son of Vasudev. The personality of Godhead and his liberated devotees, like Narada, appear in the material world by the same process. As it is said in the Bhagavad Gita, the birth and activities of the Lord are all transcendental. I believe he's referring to 4.9, 4.11. It's skipping my mind right now. Janma karma chame divyam evam yo veti tatvataha. Right. So he's referring to how when the divine comes, manifests in this world, this is something that is eternal, beyond the cosmic creation and cosmic dissolution. Continuing, therefore, according to authorized opinion, the birth of Narada as the son of Brahma is also a transcendental pastime, or lila, is the word. His appearance and disappearance are practically on the same level as that of the Lord. The Lord and his devotees are therefore simultaneously one and different as spiritual entities. They belong to the same category of transcendence. So what exactly is being spoken here, and what is the larger context? The Bhagavata is a great Sanskrit piece of literature that can be found among several various sacred texts coming from ancient India. Now, the Western traditions are religions of the book. So Western traditions have a singular scriptural focus. So, for example, Judaism has the Hebrew Bible, known commonly as the Old Testament by Christians. But the Jews don't call it the Old Testament. They call it the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the Tanakh, and so on. Christianity comes along, and they have the New Testament with the Old Testament. There's no subtracting or adding to that. Of course, there's commentary. There's a commentarial tradition. But this is a singular a focus of revelation from which they derive divine knowledge. And then the Quran comes for the Muslims, for Islam. And these are works to which each of these traditions go for their starting point, their information, revelation, wisdom, and practice. Now, in India, we start with the Vedas. The Vedas are the oldest sacred texts in the world. And they were originally transmitted orally. And the Vedas are of an extraordinary variety of sacred hymns. But basically you have hymns there in Sanskrit that are focusing on either the sacrifice, that the sacrificial practice in which humanity and divinity meet at the point of the fire sacrifice, and there is the transaction between the two. And then there is wisdom or knowledge and philosophical wonderment. Questions like, where did we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? So there are hymns dedicated to this kind of knowledge. And then there are hymns devoted to the supplications of the heart, a loving stance toward a deity, a divinity, affection, the affective part of the human. And so the Vedas very nicely correspond to the three primary attributes of a human being. We all, as human beings, we feel, we think, and we act. I think this is, you know, pretty universally accepted. We feel, we think, and we act. And so in the Vedas, the hymns reflect these activities and show how they themselves can be perfected in a kind of yoga. Now, the word yoga didn't exist as we know it as a practice of yoga, as a process of yoga, until later, until the Upanishads. But yoga was practiced for thousands of years before it even had a name. It was only until the Upanishadic period, when the Upanishads, the fifth Veda that's often called, that we find the word yoga referring to the practices of, say, Ashtanga, the Ashtanga practices. And we all know what those are, right? Maybe, okay? The eight limbs, right? You all know what those are, right? First, there is yama, right? Niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana. Everyone mispronounces that. Everyone says dharana. Please don't say dharana. Okay. It's dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. So those are the eight limbs of yoga espoused by Patanjali, not Patanjali, Patanjali. I'm sure he was a jolly fellow, but we don't put that in the pronunciation of his name. So these eight limbs, these all came to be known in a time when the Bhagavad Gita also became fully appearing before humanity and the Yoga Sutra at the same time, in roughly the same time. But the Yoga Sutra is part of the six classical philosophies of India. There's Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Mimamsa, there's the Purva Mimamsa, Uttara Mimamsa, and of course there's Yoga, and there's Vedanta. Anyway, this gets rather complicated. What I'm saying is that the sacred literatures of India are not so simple as one religion of the book. That is my point. And that religion, that philosophy and religion in India is extraordinarily rich and diverse. Now, we have to understand and appreciate that Judaism came out of Egypt and out of slavery to the Pharaoh, to the Egyptian Pharaoh. And Egyptian religion consists of a very panoramic view of the divine. And I'll restrain myself from going into all of the details there. But suffice to say that because it was understood that divinity was diverse and variegated, when the Jews were searching and when they were liberated from that enslavement to the Pharaoh and brought to the land of Israel,
by Moses, although Moses didn't make it the whole way. But they worshipped, obviously, one God. And in fact, there is the second commandment in the Decalogue that says, "Thou shalt not worship any other, images before me, for I am a jealous God." So this was very much a focus on a singular divinity, to the exclusion of any other levels of divinity or types of divinity or facets of the divine. And so in the West, what we've got here is, trouble accepting other forms of religion. There's a kind of unhealthy exclusivity that can occur. My religion is correct, yours is not. There's only one God, and that happens to be my God. And another person is saying, yes, there's only one God, but that happens to be my God. And then another person says the same. And what you've got are this plethora of religious traditions fragmenting Judaism, Christianity, and Islam that all feel that they are the saved ones and no one else is. And essentially, each one of us are going to each one of these hells that they all think we're going to. So there's so many hells that we're going to end up visiting. And it could be quite interesting. But each of these traditions say we are going to heaven and everyone else is going to hell. And all other persons say that. So we've got really everyone is going to someone else's hell. And I don't know how one makes travel plans for such a tour. But it doesn't look like a really nice tour. On the other hand, the Vedas have a very diversified, very personalized view of divinity, such that plurality, or I should even say the pluralism inherent in religious traditions, is something that was always preserved and respected. Because in the Vedas, no one was heavily oppressed or enslaved, as we find with the Jews. So human beings tend to go, in pendulum swings. There are many gods, many aspects of divinity. Okay, I was enslaved to that type of thing. Now let me go to only one. And so that's something that they've been working with. Thou shalt not create any graven image of me. Thou shalt worship no other gods before me. There's nothing said about after him, but no others before him. Now, if that commandment were written in India, it would sound very different. Thou shalt worship every possible graven image of me that you can possibly fashion, because you love me and love has no limit to the way in which you can celebrate my divinity. So it would be just the opposite. The Jews are being forbidden for having any graven images. And in the Vedas, they're basically saying, thou shalt have as many images of me as you can possibly conceive, because that is the nature of the heart. And I typically ask in the university classroom, I ask my students, so you all have smartphones. So you have pictures on there, right, of someone you love, right? I mean, maybe if not a person, then maybe a dog, okay? Because a lot of them are young and they don't necessarily have developed relationships. And I said, and they said yes. And I said, but you cannot love any other dogs, right? Or any other persons. You just have to love that one person. And they said, well, no, of course not. And I said, well, but that's what Abrahamic traditions are asking us to do. And it's not natural. Not only that, but you're not allowed to picture or depict that beloved. So you love your dog, right? But you don't have a picture on your phone, I hope, of your dog. Because that would be, blasphemous. And the reason, now here's why they say it's blasphemous, is because when you have that, what used to be called a Kodak moment, used to be a phrase, now Kodak is virtually out of business, I guess, with digital technology, but that Kodak moment freezes a person in that one moment, and you may think, of that person as nothing else. So let's say someone in here took a picture of me going like this. Then all you know of Garuda is... And that would be embarrassing. So, in other words, there's so many other moments to capture, and the moments are infinite. And so in the Western traditions, they're afraid of limiting the unlimited. But in India, there's always that awareness that you can never equal the unlimited in the celebration. But never should one's heart ever be stopped from celebrating it. So thou shalt celebrate the divine in as many forms and as many images as one possibly can, uninhibitedly. So there's a very opposite sense in India. Now what's happening here is the Bhagavata is one extraordinarily powerful sacred text that is in addition to the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavata arises out of Vyasa's dissatisfaction with his duties as an editor, as a compiler of the Vedas. He's known to be the one who records the Vedas, the compiler of the Vedas. Vyasa, his name is epithetical in meaning. It means compiler, it means editor. So in editing and compiling the Vedas, he became dissatisfied. He just felt like it wasn't enough. And so he's consulting his spiritual master, his guru, Narada Muni, about this dissatisfaction and instructs Vyasa to speak more directly about divinity and about the heart and how the heart can be totally absorbed in the divine. And so that's how the Bhagavatam comes about. But there's even a story that goes behind. There's a sort of death narrative behind this book. When there was a great king by the name of Parikshit, everyone loved Parikshit. He was a very loved king. And he was out hunting one day in the forest with a band of his men, and he got lost. And he wasn't finding his way. They ran out of water. He was getting thirsty. And like all human beings, when they get really thirsty and they're getting dehydrated, they get a little irritable. Like right now, I'm a little irritable. I need to get a little... So they were traveling. And the king came across a sage who was meditating, deep meditation. In fact, he was in samadhi. Now, I don't know about any of you, but when last time I was in samadhi, I was unaware of absolutely everything, okay? And that is why we sit in Padmasana. Everyone knows what Padmasana is, so I'm not going to demonstrate. The reason for sitting in Padmasana with each foot on the opposite leg's thigh is because it locks the body in position so you don't fall over when you go into samadhi. I've actually suggested this to many of my students in my class. They don't fall over. And it's not because of samadhi either. That's a different problem. But the Padmasana will function in the same valuable way. But so the sage is there meditating. He's completely unaware of the king's presence and his men. And the king asks him, "O sage, we're lost. We've lost our way. We are thirsty. Please help us." And the sage didn't respond. Why? Because he's in samadhi. He's completely in another realm. So the king was frustrated, and he found a snake nearby that he took with his sword, and he wrapped the snake, the dead snake, around the neck of the sage, because he felt angry. He was upset. So they went on to other parts of the forest, eventually, of course, to find their way. But the sage's son comes back. His name is Sringi. He comes back and sees his father in meditation, completely absorbed, but with this snake around the neck. And insulted, He feels so insulted on behalf of his father, and he knows that this is the king that did this, and he curses the king, because the sage's son is also very powerful, curses the king to be bitten by a snake bird. Can you imagine the like an anaconda with wings? I mean, this is scary. A snake bird who would bite him in 7 days and devour him instantly by the fiery venom possessed by the snake bird. So this is not a pretty picture, okay? And the king comes to find out about this. And apparently the king was powerful enough to reverse the curse. But he chose not to. He said, you know, this is my time. This is my time. I'm going to renounce my kingdom. I'm going to go to the forest. And I'm going to ask the great sage Shuka. The great sage Shuka, Shukadeva Gosvaman. The most important question. What is one to do to prepare for death? What is, you know, in 7 days I'm to die. What do I need to know to make this life successful? What are the most valuable and most precious things of which I must become aware in order to complete this journey of this very fleeting life? And that's the basis of this whole text. And right here, Narada is, and it's a complex text on a literary level. There are conversations within conversations within conversations. And this is called, in literary criticism, a telescoping narrative. So what we've got here, though, is this conversation between Narada and Vyasa. Vyasa, his disciple, who's suggesting to Vyasa that he really come through with this most important message. And that is how to find, as the Upanishads calls it, the space within the heart. The space within the heart. Hridayakasha. And this is the whole point of the yoga process, is to find that space within the heart and to dwell within it. So, there is much discussion about yoga in this text. Here, Narada is about to go into a discussion of the great, vast amounts of time in the cosmic cosmogenesis, the creation of this earth and the dissolution of this earth. Again, contrasting the Bible begins with, you know, God created the heavens and the earth in 7 days. And that's something that's very much, you know, appreciated in the Western traditions. And in fact, God, 82% of Westerners think of God first as the creator. But in India, creation, cosmic creation and cosmic dissolution is farmed out to someone else. It's not the ultimate. And so here it's Brahma, the creator, and Shiva, the one in charge of cosmic dissolution. And this cycle of creation and dissolution is going on all the time. Just like every moment we experience now is created and then it dissolves. It comes into being and then goes out of being. As we're sitting here, every single moment comes and goes. And that's the nature of this world. That is the nature of Prakriti. So, what we have then in the Bhagavata is a text that moves us ever toward the heart. It moves us toward self-realization, but even then, it goes beyond self-realization to a total selfless state of self-giving. And that is what the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali moves us toward, if we know how to read it. And so since we have today here a little yoga class and with their venerable teacher here, Kumi, I thought I would share a little bit of what I'm coming across in that practice, in that philosophy and practice of yoga, just briefly, because right now I'm translating the Patanjali Yoga Sutra to be published by Yale University Press. And you know, the question might be, why did Yale even accept my proposal? Because there are many extant translations available right on the bookshelf. There's, you know, this one and that one. I won't mention names, but they're all, in many ways, you know, fine presentations. But I think you'll find in each one of them a certain lacking at certain parts of the Yoga Sutra. There seems to be a kind of incompleteness in the interpretation of the Yoga Sutra, which is was a concern of mine, and I put this forward to the editors at Yale and my evaluators, and they were totally won over because I showed them how a complete interpretation of the Yoga Sutra is possible with the Bhaktivilochana, the Prema Netra, the eye of love, the eye of devotion. And how, really, this text is not an isolated text from the Bhagavad Gita, but rather can be understood and appreciated as something extremely compatible with the Bhagavad Gita and with the Bhagavata as well. And so Patanjali begins his sutra text of 196 aphorisms. Atha yoganu shasanam now begins at this auspicious point. This sutra on yoga, it's systematic teaching. Many translators miss that anushasanam. They think of just shasanam teaching, but it's an anushasanam. That upasarga or prefix is referring to a systematic teaching. That means that you should be able to interpret the whole of the text fully. And basically, where the Yoga Sutra wants to take us is the same place that the practice of Bhakti Yoga takes us, which is the state of purity of the heart, purity of emotion, purity of devotion, without a tinge. And I always love shocking my yoga students in workshops when I'm doing 500 trainings or 200, I guess now it's called 300 training, 300-hour training, when I say that when reaches samadhi, right, the ashtanga, the eight limbs, once you reach that, you've got seven more steps to go. You may not know that, but seven more steps. And why is that? Because even at the stage of samadhi, you may not have a pure samadhi, what's called in the Yoga Sutra, nirbija samadhi. So Patanjali speaks about these graduated steps, just the way that Rupa Goswaman talks about the graduated steps on the way to prema, or purest love. So there is this. So there are these seven more steps. So after attaining samadhi, you have these sabbija steps. So you have savitarka samadhi, nirvitarka samadhi, savichara samadhi, savichara, nirvichara, and so on. Little tinges of self-consciousness, self-awareness, which you want to get away from. You want to attain a pure state of self-forgetfulness and total absorption in the divine beloved. And that's what the Yoga Sutra is concerned with, and that is what the Bhagavata and the Bhagavad Gita is concerned with. They both are going to the same place. Now, a lot of people don't understand these other seven steps. I like to explain it by, if you're watching a good movie, if the movie's really good, you're not multitasking, right? You're not doing other things. You're cleaning the dishes, watching the movie. No. That doesn't work. If you're watching a movie, you're glued to the film, okay? But if at some point you start saying, it's a really good movie, okay? You're not going to switch. You like this film. You're absorbed in it. But you start reflecting, I wonder if that really could happen. Okay. You're now stepping away. You're moving out of the rasa, out of the zone, if you will. Like in sports, they call it the zone. You know, when you're hitting the ball, right, in tennis, the other person's hitting it back, and the other person's hitting it, and you're just, there's this beautiful mutuality going back and forth in the volley. And then if I'm in that volley and I think, I'm really good, what happens? I dropped the ball. That's right. As soon as I become self-conscious, I'm moving out of that relationship, that volley. And with the divine, that's called rasa. And so in a movie, in any art form, if you start questioning it slightly, this is not totally believable. I mean, L.A., isn't this the land of Hollywood? Is this where Hollywood is, I think, right? I'm not sure. I think maybe it is. Okay. Anyway, this is where these movies, every producer of a movie wants to absorb, ideally, his or her audience fully and suspend all other awareness. That's good art. That's beautiful poetry. The Bhagavad Gita does that for me. The Bhagavad, these sacred texts. Patanjali's Yoga Sutra does that for me now. Yeah. But as soon as you start thinking and reflecting a little bit, that's vichara, reasoning, reflecting. Even if you are aware of how much you're enjoying the film, that too is a distraction. That's even a subtler distraction, according to Patanjali. And here's the last level of distraction, asmita. Even if you're aware that you exist, even if you remember your name during the film, that means you're not totally absorbed. So in meditation, this is possible. It is possible to be totally forgetful of who we are and be utterly given over to the object of meditation. That is the meaning of samadhi. It means to be placed completely over into the object of meditation. And this is Krishna bhakti. This is the beauty of this process, that we're learning how to exercise the heart in the purest possible way. So in yoga, there's a kind of paradox. In yoga, we want to block out the rest of the world. I don't want to see you. I don't want to see you. I don't want to see you. I don't see anybody. Okay, I'm going inside, and I'm tempted to do that right now. I'm tempted to do that right now, despite the fact that I'm supposed to be talking to all of you. I just want to go into meditation. I want to gain as much self-realization, not your self-realization, my self-realization. So in one sense, it's a kind of egocentric process where we become fully self-realized. But when we become so wealthy with self-realization, like any wealth, any person who has an extraordinary amount of wealth, we want to give it away. And that's what happens in bhakti. We become so filled with self-awareness, so filled with self-realization, that we just want to forget about ourselves now. Instead of realize ourselves, we want to now forget about ourselves and become completely devoted to others and to the Supreme Other. We become sensitive to all of life. All life, all everything divine. We have a new vision of things. We have a new way of seeing things. This is the real point of yoga. Yoga means union. And what is union if you're so busy thinking about yourself? Even in regular relationships. Oh yeah, I have a friend, but I'm not interested in him. I just tell him about myself. What kind of friendship is that? There has to be a kind of mutuality, a loving exchange. So I'll just finally say that there's so much to learn about this very rigorous psychological, spiritual, really a psycho-spiritual process called yoga. And that bhakti is at the highest end. It is the innermost realm of bhakti. It doesn't preclude knowledge and the cognitive aspects. It doesn't preclude acting in the world. No, quite to the contrary. It includes all of these. But ultimately, it's the heart that has to really deepen and expand and move outward everywhere. I'll just end by saying that, when we come into this world, have you ever seen a baby human? Little human blobs? They don't do much. Have you seen those? They're kind of chubby and the limbs are useless. Have you noticed? Okay. So those limbs, so a baby human cannot act, right? It can't act. It has no facility for acting. And then can it think? No, it can't think. You know, it's just been around for a little, you know, while, and it hasn't, you know, hasn't gone to got an education or anything like that. So, really, what is it? It's a big bundle of feeling. We come into this world feeling, and we expect feeling in return. The first yoga is between the mother and the child. This is the first yoga, and this is explained in the Upanishads as anamaya realization. And we don't have time to go into all the steps. But anyway, we come into this world feeling. And we have the need to reciprocate that feeling with the mother. And when we leave this world, when we're on our deathbeds, we're not very active at that point. Have you noticed, right? I mean, it's not no time to act on the deathbed. And thinking it's a little late for that. It's just a little late for that. If you need to think about death, do as Maharaj Pariksha did. At least you got 7 days. But, you know, he wasn't on his deathbed. He was just going to get bitten and, you know, just vanished like that. So that has its advantages. But the point is that, again, there's no time to act, no time to think. It's what's left is in your heart. It's what you take. That's when you've really prepared for your long journey. If I told all of you suddenly, you have 5 minutes to say goodbye to everybody in the West. I'm taking you to China. We're moving to a remote area of China, never to return again. This would be really unfair. You'd say, Garuda, this is unfair. We haven't had time to say goodbye or even pack our bags. Well, but a lot of people go through life suddenly taking that journey, saying that very same thing. I'm not prepared. I'm not ready. And in earlier verses in the Bhagavatam here, Narada is also talking about how he prepared for death. And death then becomes a euphemism for life, life eternal. Death carries a connotation of something permanent and final and sort of dissolving, a kind of nihilistic state of non-being. Non-existence. For the bhakta, as exhibited by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he could barely handle being in a body. He had so much love and so much devotion. And so his body was constantly, people are having to pick up his body all the time and deal with him. His love was so uncontainable that, frankly, it really needed to die. It needed to be shed. And that's the position of the yogi, or yogini, not yogini. Mispronounced all the time, right? As yogini, right? Do you pronounce it as yogini? No, not anymore. No, it's yogini, okay? If it rhymes with fettuccine, linguine, it's probably an Italian preparation. Okay? But it is yogini. Yogini, okay? So, yogini. But this is the goal of every yogi or yogini, is to fill up one's heart so much, with so much love, that when death comes, it is an opportunity simply to expand one's sphere. And that's yoga. That's bhakti. I'll stop there and ask for any comments or questions or... That's fine. Okay, so we end now?
Yeah, we can do that now.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
So we'll have breakfast with the next door. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm so inspired. I got it.
You got
ready?
It.
I got it.